I'm going to change my introduction because I was going to start with suggesting that people might come here with a question of why the Russian Revolution is still relevant today. But given the number of people in the room, I think it's much more worthwhile going over why people still, after over 90 years, find the Russian Revolution so inspiring. And I'll start the answer, I think, fittingly with Trotsky, one of the great orators and popular leaders of the Russian Revolution, who reminds us that in ordinary times, history is made by specialists in that line of business. Kings, ministers, bureaucrats, parliamentarians, journalists. The history of a revolution is first of all the history of the forcible entrance of the masses into the realm of rulership over their own destiny. And nowhere was this more the case than in Russia, 1917. Only in Russia has the working class succeeded in achieving state power, however briefly, of proving that the masses of people are actually capable of running society in their own interests. So, to set the scene, Russia at the turn of the century was a country that was economically and politically underdeveloped relative to its neighbour Europe. It had been ruled for centuries by an autocratic regime in which the smallest voice raised in opposition was automatically suppressed. Political freedoms did not exist. In 1905, a revolution had brought the Tsarist regime to its knees, but it had managed to survive. Although this revolution has been described as the dress rehearsal for the later one, and it did indeed provide a significant number of workers with invaluable political lessons that they were to put into practice in 1917. One of the most crucial factors in shaping the 1917 revolution was the growing concentration of the industrial working class of the main cities in huge workplaces that served as organising centres for the revolution. In fact, in Petrograd in 1917, 68% of industrial workers worked in enterprises of 1,000 or more workers, and this outranked, in terms of concentration, even the US and Germany, who were the main industrial powers at the time. Another important factor in the development of the revolution was the First World War. You know, Russia suffered the bulk of casualties throughout the war, and those that didn't die suffered from a lack of proper equipment, clothing, shelter and food in the horrific conditions of the trenches. In the rear, the huge state mobilisation created disastrous food shortages and a worsening of working conditions as productivity was pushed up. For those at the top, however, just like today, war profits were flourishing. And Trotsky described the obscene situation. Enormous fortunes rose out of the bloody foam. Lady-in-waiting Vorobeva says that in no other season were such gowns to be seen as in the winter of 1915-16, and never had so many diamonds been bought. A continual shower of gold fell from above. Society held out its hands and pockets. Aristocratic ladies spread their skirts high. All came running to grab and gobble in fear lest the blessed rain should stop. And all rejected with indignation the shameful idea of a premature peace. But among those who gained nothing but misery, hatred for the war and the people that were ordering it grew with every story of court excess, with every order to speed up production and every plea for workers to tighten their belts. So the revolution spark ignited on International Working Women's Day, the 23rd of February, when women textile workers came out on the streets demanding bread and an end to the war. By the end of the day, 90,000 workers were on strike as women had marched from factory to factory, calling on other workers to join them. The next day, 200,000 workers were on strike in Petrograd, swelling even more over the following days. But the turning point came with the rebellion of the Petrograd soldiers on the 27th. That day also, news of the Petrograd rebellion arrived in Moscow, and immediately crowds of workers disarmed police stations, freed political prisoners, and began to form new governing bodies, including a Soviet of workers' deputies. By March the 3rd, the Tsar, the last of a dynasty that had ruled Russia with an iron fist for 300 years, had abdicated. The mood across the country was euphoric. But the outcome of this amazing event proved to be contradictory. At first, it seemed as if the whole population was united by the revolution. You know, even the top generals had at the last minute advised the Tsar to abdicate. Everyone declared for the revolution. But this unity only briefly obscured the true nature of the situation, what is called dual power, in that two institutions, you know, the Soviets representing the working class and then later the soldiers and peasants on one hand, and the provisional government representing the capitalists and landlords, competed for state power. It was a situation that, impacted by the war and the worsening economic crisis, was unstable at best. The irreconcilable interests of the social classes on which they both rested would be exacerbated and drive them into a conflict that defined the year and from which only one could survive. So the provisional government was appointed by the parliament that had been elected under the Tsar in elections that were so limited that the main representatives were those of the capitalists and landlords, even though they were a tiny minority of the population. And in particular, the Cadet Party, which was the party of the liberal bourgeoisie. I'll talk about them a bit later. And this quote from Trotsky, I think, really sums up the irony of the situation after February. "Thus, as a result of a victorious insurrection of workers and soldiers, there appeared at the helm of government a handful of the very richest landlords and industrialists. Remarkable for less than nothing, political dilettantes without a program, and at the head of them a prince with a strong dislike for excitement." Such a leadership for a revolution. But the workers and soldiers later the peasants had a different answer to the question of how to run society. In 1905, the workers had established Soviets, which is Russian for workers' councils, and immediately during the February days, they did so again. And Soviets were the most democratic form of social organisation yet seen. So you imagine, the delegates were recallable at any time if those that elected them weren't happy with their decisions. They weren't paid higher than the average wage of those that elected them. Deputies also remained in the workplace or the barracks from which they were elected from, which ensured that they actually shared the consequences of the decisions that they voted on in higher bodies. These structures relied upon the support of the majority of the workers, soldiers and peasants, rather than the economic power of a minority like the capitalist state today and the provisional government in 1917. And I want to just pause for a second to contrast this with, you know, what happens today in politics. It makes me smile. Can you imagine what it would be like if those in Canberra had to worry about getting the sack, you know, more than just every 3 years by those that elected them? And it brings a smile to my face imagining hypothetical John Howard, who had been booted out while still in office for introducing the highly unpopular work choices legislation, having to supplement his parliamentary income with a job at, or let's say, you know, Spotlight, the the fabric company that recently signed their workforce onto AWAs that made them $140 a week worse off. I'm sure the staff there would have had a wonderful time making him accountable. Anyway, enough dreaming. By the end of May, there were over a dozen district and sub-district Soviets. Thanks. Throughout Petrograd and its surrounding areas, and a national Soviet was soon established. The main activity of the local Soviets tended to be dealing with food supply, the maintenance of public order, labour disputes and social welfare. In short, the role of organising society in the district in which they headed. So to put it more bluntly, workers had created for themselves their own governing bodies. The factory committee, which was shop floor committees elected in the workplaces, also contributed to the organisation of the working class. For example, in the Gazan factory, the largest metalworks in Moscow, the committee submitted a list of demands after February to management that included creating a permanent space for the workers' committee and for general factory meetings, lectures and other cultural and educational activities. Sick pay, maternity leave before and after birth, medicine to be distributed by the factory, and annual vacation leave. So you can see that alongside, you know, the organisation of production, social and political questions were of central concern also. And I think it's an important point to make that, you know, when it seems like even the most timeless things are up for grabs, like, you know, factory management or state power, that and so on, that this instability flowed through into a flowering of debate and action on the most intimate questions of people's lives. For example, you know, particularly women's oppression was challenged as maternity leave, equal pay and respectful treatment were demanded by women participants of the revolution. So, on the one side, the Soviet of workers, soldiers and later peasants' deputies holding in their hand the support of the entire working class and a vast majority of the army. On the other, grouped behind the provisional government were the privileged classes. But the real power lay in the hands of the Soviets. And the Minister for War, and no friend of the Soviets, Guchkov, admitted, the government has no real power. The troops, the railroads, the posts and telegraphs are in the hands of the Soviets. The simple fact is that the provisional government exists only so long as the Soviet permits it. So that, of course, begs the question, why did the provisional government exist at all? And the answer lies partly in the politics of the main socialist party at the time of the February Revolution, the Mensheviks and the socialist revolutionaries, I'll refer to as the SRs. The SRs were the peasant socialist party and wavered between wings that supported the capitalists and those that swung in behind the Bolsheviks. And towards the end of the year, they had effectively split into these two camps. The Mensheviks thought that because Russia had not yet reached the stage of capitalism, it was not possible to achieve socialism. Therefore, the coming revolution would be a limited revolution with the capitalist class at the head. Because of this, workers needed to be mindful and not go too far in case they scared off the capitalists. So in practical terms, what that meant was that they were trying to straddle two hostile social classes who, under the influence of the war and economic trouble, were polarising rapidly. So in the end, they satisfied no one. After April, when Lenin arrived from exile, the Bolsheviks instead argued that the workers would have to lead the revolution. The dynamic of the struggle would move inexorably towards the question of the working class taking state power. Lenin argued that the Soviets could have taken power peacefully if the Mensheviks and SRs had wished to do so. They did not. Instead, in crisis after crisis that shook the provisional government in the months between February and October, the Mensheviks and SRs sided with the capitalists. And to give just one example, the first major crisis for the provisional government came in April, barely a month after the collapse of the Tsarist regime. The Minister for Foreign Affairs, Miliukov, who was also head of the Cadet Party, sent a note to the Allies declaring that Russia still wished to bring the war to a decisive victory and reasserted Russia's claims for the Dardanelles and Constantinople. In other words, that the provisional government had no intention of ending the war anytime soon. They wanted to see it outcome as victory and that they still wished to gain colonies out of it. The reaction in Petrograd was immediate, with mass demonstrations calling for the end to the war. In some cases, the demand for all power to the Soviets was raised. And the response of the Mensheviks and the SRs was to join in coalition government with the Cadets. During the summer, the economic situation worsened, making, you know, workers convinced that this was a result of sabotage by factory owners to try and wind back the revolutions, and in most cases they were right. To stop this, the factory committees took on more far-reaching controls of production, including checking books and accounts. Imagine this in your workplace. Insisting that management decisions be ratified by factory committees and carrying out investigations of factory closures. One estimate suggests that by October, 74% of the industrial workforce in Petrograd was already working under some form of workers' control. This led to improvements in working conditions, and it's no wonder that workers didn't want to hand back control to the hated owners of the factories. And only the Bolsheviks stood for consolidating workers' control in the factories, and this was one of the main reasons for their rising popularity. Soldiers also began voting for the Bolsheviks because they were the only party opposing the war and the reintroduction of disciplinary measures like the death penalty at the front. This rise in popularity was temporarily halted following the so-called July days when workers and soldiers anxious to transfer power to the Soviets staged a series of armed demonstrations. The provisional government went on the attack against the Bolsheviks. Trotsky and other Bolshevik leaders were jailed, Lenin had to go into hiding, and the Bolshevik press was closed. The right used this opportunity to demand that the socialists in the provisional government support harsh measures to reinstitute old order in the military. And the Mensheviks and their Tsars were complicit in the suppression of the Bolsheviks. So along with the radicalisation of the working class went the radicalisation in the opposite direction of the possessing classes. The possibility of a third way, some more peaceful alternative to the bloody suppression of the revolution or the taking of power by the Soviets, no longer existed. Neither the working class and soldiers nor the generals and capitalists would stand for it. Guzon, is the owner of the factory that I mentioned earlier, wrote in his memoirs of the preparations that the capitalists were making to take the initiative. He wrote, "A private committee consisting of banks and insurance companies was organised. In order to give an official justification for our existence, we called ourselves the Society for the Economic Rehabilitation of Russia." Sounds much like a right-wing think tank today. Actually, we set ourselves for ourselves the aim of establishing a large fund for supporting moderate bourgeois candidates to the Constituent Assembly and for combating the influence of socialists at the front. In the end, we decided to place the large funds that we had collected at the disposal of General Kornilov for the purposes of organising an armed struggle against the Soviets. He is referring to the abortive coup in August by Kornilov, who the other General Alexeev described as a man with a lion's heart and the brains of sheep. In fact, Kerensky, the head of the provisional government, had begun negotiations with Kornilov for the general to enter Petrograd, suppress the Soviets and the Bolsheviks, and hand over power to Kerensky in order to thoroughly crush the insurrection, to pacify the capital, as they called it. It was only when Kerensky actually realised that the general was actually intent on overthrowing himself and the provisional government as well as the Soviets that he backed away and finally actually announced what Kornilov was doing. The coup turned into a total shambles as railway and telegraph workers made it impossible for Kornilov to get anywhere near Petrograd. And others persuaded Kornilov's troops to turn against him. The total disarray of the coup attempt, I think, is eloquent testimony to the power of the working class and the ordinary soldiers in the army. The reactionaries could fume all day at the audacity of the Soviet. They could lament the disrespect of the lower orders all they liked, but their plans fell to pieces without the support of those they wished to dominate. The decisive role in Petrograd's defence was played by the Bolsheviks. Sukarnov, a left Menshevik, but no friend of the Bolsheviks, described the role played by the Bolsheviks. And I think it's important in this point because he recognises just how much workers and soldiers are following the Bolsheviks. This is what he says. "The committee for the struggle against the counter-revolution, which was set up by the Petrograd Soviet to counter Kornilov's attempted coup, making defence preparations, had to mobilise the worker-soldier masses. But the masses, insofar as they were organised by the Bolsheviks and followed them. Without the Bolsheviks, it could only have passed the time with appeals and idle speeches by orators who had lost their authority." And here he's talking about the SRs and the Mensheviks. "With the Bolsheviks, the committee had at its disposal the full power of the organised workers and soldiers." So the defeat of Kornilov was the vindication in the eyes of workers and soldiers of the programme of the Bolsheviks. Already the Bolsheviks had won control of many, if not most, of the local Soviets and factory committees before the attempted counter-revolution. Then on, the corner lot coup only served to quicken that process. On September 5, the Bolsheviks were elected to a majority of the Petrograd Soviet with Trotsky as chairman. The Moscow Soviet followed 5 days later, and then other regional industrial centres, and then this then spread to villages and the front. And to give you just some indication of the enormous swing to the Bolsheviks throughout the year, the Moscow garrison, which is all the soldiers protecting Moscow, in June had voted 70% for the SRs. By October, 90% were voting for the Bolsheviks. So among the most militant and politically conscious workers and soldiers, the Bolshevik influence was hegemonic. Those that don't support the insurrection in October fail to see the importance of the swing in popular support to the Bolsheviks. The party won these majorities because they were the only mass socialist party that consistently backed the demands of workers, soldiers and peasants. They had, since April, openly called for the transfer of power to the Soviets. As events proved them right time and time again, more and more workers agreed with this program and joined the party or voted for them in the democratic organs of the revolution. October, seen in this light, was the culmination of the march of events since February. As the tension between the provisional government and the Bolshevik-led Soviets mounted, debates and resolutions raged across the country. At the front and in the capitals, resolutions supporting a defence of the Soviets against the provisional government were passed constantly. Everywhere, people were discussing what attitude to take to the seizure of power by the Soviets. Kerensky and the provisional government could no longer afford to cower in impotence. On October 19, he ordered Cossacks to raid the Kaluga Soviet and arrest the leaders. On the 24th, he ordered the arrest of the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet, which was made up mostly Bolsheviks, the removal to the front of the Petrograd soldiers that were sympathetic to the Bolsheviks, and the shutting down of the Bolshevik press. Immediately, the Bolsheviks and their supporters moved into action. Workers seized control of the strategically important bridges, arrested the Duma, and began setting up checkpoints across the city. And Trotsky describes a scene that is very different from the supposed coup. And he says, in the Vyborg district, which is a workers' district in Petrograd, a whole camp was created. The street was jammed full of wagons, passenger cars and trucks. The institutions of the district were swarming with armed workers. The Soviet, the Duma, the trade unions, the factory and shop committees, everything in this district was serving the cause of the insurrection. The same thing was happening throughout the capital. They were crowding out some and electing others, breaking the last threads of the old and strengthening the new. The human masses were crystallising along new axes. A revolution was achieving itself. The provisional government's response to this, I think, highlights their lack of support. They could not find enough soldiers who were willing to defend themselves against the Bolshevik supporters, so instead Kerensky and his ministers spent the day holed up in the Winter Palace making pie-in-the-sky decisions about what should be done. And just what did these glorious leaders of the democracy order as their power over the revolution slipped through their fingers? They decided on establishing a cadet who everyone else hated because of their role in supporting the Kornilov coup as a dictator with unlimited powers to crush the insurrection. But as it turned out, Kerensky was forced to flee Petrograd in a car donated by the American embassy because all the trains and cars in the city were controlled by the Soviets. And just contrast this with the enthusiasm of the Kronstadt and Finnish sailors who had sailed an armada to Petrograd to back up the Bolsheviks. And Pavlov, a sailor from Kronstadt, recalled, what did the Gulf of Finland around Kronstadt and Petrograd look like then? This is conveyed well by a song that was popular at the time, sung to the melody of an old folk tune. From the island of Kronstadt toward the river Neva Broad, there are many boats a-sailing. They have Bolsheviks on board. The Menshevik Martov, an old sparring partner of Lenin, warned his comrades, understand, please, that before us all is the victorious uprising of the proletariat. Almost the entire proletariat supports Lenin and expects its social liberation from this uprising. Thanks. The All-Russian Congress of Soviets met on October 25 following the transfer of power in the name of the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet. The Bolsheviks and those close to them had a majority of the delegates. The Bolsheviks, you know, a questionnaire of delegates that, you know, turned up to Petrograd for the Congress shows that 505 of the 670 delegates had come with the principle of supporting the slogan, all power to the Soviets. In other words, they had come supporting a transfer of power. Now they were assured of its accomplishment. Immediately, Lenin proclaimed to the Congress, the Soviet authority will at once propose a democratic peace to all nations and an immediate armistice on all fronts. It will safeguard the transfer without compensation of all land to the peasant committees. It will defend the soldiers' rights, introducing the complete democratization of the army. It will establish workers' control over industry, and it will secure to all nationalities inhabiting Russia the right to self-determination. So what the provisional government, supported by the Mensheviks, had delayed for 8 months, causing the deaths of tens of thousands at the front, starvation in the cities and growing hostility in the countries, the Bolsheviks announced immediately. Finally, the demands of the workers and soldiers who had participated in the revolution were actually reflected in its leading bodies. In the first year, the decrees of the Soviet government included universal suffrage, abolishing the right of inheritance, making marriage a voluntary relationship free of state and church control. Illegitimacy was abolished as a legal concept. Paid maternity leave before and after birth was enshrined in law. Adultery and homosexuality were removed from the criminal code. Also, the 8-hour day, equal pay, childcare, and communal kitchens were established by law. 125,000 literacy schools were set up, and factories created education commissions that put on theatre productions, poetry readings, and orchestral concerts. I think if we think about how, you know, far short of these laws and social programs, our, you know, of over 90 years ago, our society falls even today, we should recognise the immense potential of a society that is created by the conscious intervention of the masses. Tomorrow afternoon there is going to be a session on what happened in Russia after the revolution, but I think it's useful now to discuss the important questions that the revolution itself raises. That is centrally, I think, how the working class and oppressed of Russia, through the development of mass democratic structures of the Soviets and the conscious confrontation with the rule of capital, shows us even today a glimpse of the potential for a radically different and better society. Thanks.